certainly did take up my invitation to interrupt me anytime they wanted to. And I reiterate that invitation and congratulate you on having a cell phone grasp. It's good. So I will start talking and will continue to do so unless and until someone interrupts me. But you're really extremely welcome to interrupt me. You're certain. You might as well discuss what you're interested in. So if you have further questions about anything I'm saying or anything I've written or anything else that seems to you in the neighborhood of what's in your discussions, I invite you to at least propose this topic. If I'm repelled by it, I will move on. So looking at the second handout, I thought I'd just start very quickly by reminding you of some of what goes on in these discussions by pointing to what I'm going to call a standard interpretation of the Tractatus. This could be defined more precisely in the paper we're reading for next week, the Mild Motto Wittgensteinianism paper. Actually, go to some trouble to characterize it more precisely. I'm not going to do that right now unless somebody feels I should. But what I'm going to just do is exemplify this kind of interpretation through some quotations. So the first quotation from Hacker is meant to be a fairly mild expression of the standard interpretation. That is, everything depends upon how one takes what Hacker is saying here. One of the things that Hacker does in this first quotation is he draws a distinction between illuminating nonsense and misleading nonsense. And he says that the Tractatus depends upon such a distinction. The Tractatus is concerned to criticize philosophers for speaking nonsense. So not only examples of nonsense seem to be virtuous, since they are targets of criticism, the Tractatus also, at the conclusion of the book, clearly identifies many of its own sentences as nonsense and wants those sentences to somehow help us, which suggests that at least some employments of nonsense are supposed to be helpful, or, to borrow a phrase, illuminating. So far, so good. One thing I want to say is I don't think there's anything wrong with that distinction drawn that vaguely. I think we've got to have some such distinction to make sense of the book and what it's up to. But the question is how it should be unpacked. There's already in this quotation, there's a suggestion about how the idea of illuminating nonsense should be unpacked. Whereas misleading nonsense just cannot be understood, it suggests that in the case of misleading nonsense, that we cannot understand what it says. We construe the sentence as saying something, as we would a sentence that makes sense. The sentence will fail the test of saying something. There is nonetheless something we can do. Hacker characterizes this in various ways. I've italicized them for you. We can apprehend what is shown by the sentences, one way he puts it. We can grasp what is meant, is another, he puts it. Apprehend what is shown. Well, those words could just be, more words for what we called illuminating before. I don't think, it's clear from that there's a problem. All depends upon how we unpack the idea of apprehend what is shown. What often happens in the commentary is that there's an attempt to identify that idea of showing with the one that actually figures as a term of art in the Tractatus, when he distinguishes between saying and showing. This is very clear in the Meredith Williams article that I'm responding to in a piece that's recommended for next week. I can make that available to anyone who wants to see it. She's very helpful in just having a very clear instance of this. So the Tractatus does distinguish between saying and showing. But I'm going to claim that if you read the text carefully, that distinction, the distinction between what is said and what is shown, only applies to expressions that have a symbolic structure. Only that which can be expressed in a logical symbolism, only that which can be segmented, only that which gives rise to the parsing of a symbol, that has a sense, that says something, or at least has the form of something that says something, can be said to show something. So sentences which are zinful or zinlos can show something. Whereas I think the Tractatus is quite clear that if something is unzin, then it's not got the structure to be shown. What this kind of formulation suggests is there's some more generic notion of showing, such that those cases and nonsense can both show, and we're getting an elucidation of the species of the genus showing that applies to nonsense. That, I think, is a confused idea. I don't think it's a confused idea that's irrelevant to understanding the Tractatus. I think it's a confused idea that's under criticism in the Tractatus. But I don't think the text supports the attribution of that idea. That's one way Hacker has of putting it. The other way, which I italicize, is grasp what is meant. And all I'll say about this right now is that you get this kind of thing a lot in Tractatus scholarship. And you say, well, wait a minute, you know, grasp what is meant. I thought, you know, only propositions mean things. I thought only, you know, that which, you know, is a proposition and part of language can mean something. The limits of language are the limits of thought. So I thought I could only grasp what is said or intended or thought by a sentence that means something. These are all just paraphrasing things that Tractatus says. And then usually what the commentator will say at this point is, well, yeah, of course. Yeah, I don't mean literally grasp what is literally meant, because that you can only do if something is said, or at least some saying is going on. You can sometimes grasp something that's meant that's not said, in the sense that you can read between the lines. But you can even only do that if you can first read the lines. So they're going to say, no, we have to, quote, grasp what is, quote, meant, unquote. So these expressions themselves are deployed to mark something that's supposed to be a kind of traffic in something that's meaning-like and conveying of the meaning-like, without actually being instances of it. And the question is whether, A, you can spell out this idea in a coherent way, B, whether there's a reason to attribute to the Tractatus the ambition to spell out such a conception, and C, whether, and this is, I think, really the key issue, you can actually build a strong enough firewall to protect these ideas from what looks to me to be the Tractarian criticism of such an attempt to, if you will, stretch the limits of thought so that they outrun the limits of language. So there is at least a kind of grasping, a kind of meaning that extends beyond the province of the sample. Now, as I said, this first quotation from Hacker all depends upon how much weight you put on the italicized expressions, whether you think it's really a standard reading or not. But in quotation two, we have Hacker spelling out how the mechanism for grasping what is meant in such cases is supposed to work, apprehending what is shown. At this point, you definitely do have something that is, by my lens, no longer controversially a case of the standard reading. So he says, we do this by trying to express what he calls categorical necessity. There's a further characterization of these unsayable somethings that can be conveyed by trying to say in language that which cannot be said, and by the keener grasping that which the proposition would say if it could say it, but coming to see that it cannot say it. And the sorts of things that are thus graspable but unsayable, he characterizes here as categorical necessity. So there's some picture of there being fundamental truths about the structure of the language itself, and the structure of language itself. We might at some point come back to this word, language, and ask ourselves what we're talking about in the context of the Tractatus. That's just a note for a little bit later today. So this idea of categorical necessities reflects the idea that what's happening is that there is a kind of structure that's built into the language. But when language itself tries to reflect on this structure, it breaks its own rules. It cannot do this. It runs up against the limits. So that structure is really there in the language. It reflects a kind of set of necessities. But those necessities cannot be grasped by the language. You cannot turn the language. Language cannot round on itself in that way. That's something like the picture you have in a standard interpretation. Now, I've just put this in a way that's extremely neutral with respect to a further set of interpretive issues, which I'd mostly like to talk about next week and the following week when we look at the other paper. But I'll just flag them now. I haven't said anything about, according to the standard interpretation, why language cannot do this. And at this point, I think standard interpreters take very different forks in the road. And by my lights, you're equaling the standard interpreter, regardless of how you answer that question. But examples of answers you get are, because our ability to say anything about the world and the kind of necessities it has reflects the necessities that are built into language itself. So the reason you cannot say certain kinds of things about reality is because to talk about reality requires language and the structures that reality have and therefore function of the structures of language. We might call this a kind of linguistic idealist meaning, or for short, just linguistic idealism, or just idealism. The idea is structures that we impose, given the kind of mindedness or language we have, places conditions on ourselves, the kinds of, what was going on here, necessities, or sorry, that reality can be taken out. Another view is, no, the reason language has these structures built into it is because reality has these structures built into it. Reality itself has a logical structure, so to say. If language wishes to refer to and talk about reality, language must reflect the structure of reality. So a common theme throughout the standard interpretations is an insistence on the idea that there is a kind of form that language has and a kind of form that reality has, and that these are mirrored in the two. But where a lot of interpreters agree is once you notice this kind of mirroring, wondering what is the dog and what is the tail. If one thinks, one asks the question, why is this, and one wants to adduce a direction of explanation, whether one should take the necessities to be lodged in the structure of reality and language to be reflecting them, or vice versa. This is often called, in the context of readings of the Tractatus, realism, or sometimes metaphysical realism, about the ontological status of these necessities. So there's various kinds of claims. You cannot, predicate a second level function of an object, is an example we'll look at in a moment. You cannot quantify in certain kinds of ways. There's certain kinds of contexts in which you cannot make identity statements. Russell's theory of types is an example of a set of things. What looks like one cannot say, one must debar oneself from saying, when one get into trouble. So you have these various kinds of, you cannot do X, for a whole lot of different cases that initially come up as topics in Frege, Russell, early Wittgenstein logic. And then the question is, what's your account of the cannot, when you say you cannot predicate something at type level 1 of something at type level 3. And one account would be an idealist account. One account would be a realist account. As I said, we'll go into this more in the coming weeks. I just wanted to flag right now that both of these sorts of accounts depend on the idea of certain kind of conception of what these necessities are and how they are to be identified. And if something counts as a standard interpretation or standard reading, the Tractatus for me, if it buys into that conception, regardless of which answer it is. I'll just note parenthetically here that a place it looks to me like the Tractatus ends up on these issues is by saying something of the form, idealism and realism, strictly thought through, streng durchgedacht, collapse into one another, or coincide with one another. Which suggests that the Tractatus has a view of this in which something that looks like it makes an enormous difference to commentators is in the end to be seen as not resting on a difference but on a fundamental shared premise. So categorical necessities, back to the Hacker quote, quotation two, are reflected in the formation rules of language. Reflected, you know, is sort of nice. It involves that trope of mirror and Wong being quite neutral about whether it's reflecting something that's prior, which is the more natural way to take a matter to work, or whether it's reflecting something that's fundamental. Any attempt to express them involves the violation of the rules of logical syntax. And this is something that, whatever their, let's put the whole phrase, whatever their stripe is, until very recently, commentary, violation of the rules of syntax. My handwriting is even messier than usual. I hope you can read this. Violation of the rules of syntax. Some formulation like this. Until very recently, almost all commentary in the Tractatus is found absolutely indispensable. It looked like you couldn't express the Tractatus view without some such idea. The way this nonsense is produced is by violating certain rules. And there's a number of questions here. What are these rules? What is their status? Where do they come from? They're called rules of syntax, or rules of logical syntax, if you will. And the idea they can be violated. So one just brief kind of scholarly note, I'll try not to give you too many of these, but this one I think is worth mentioning, is if you look through the Tractatus, you will nowhere find this expression, let me take. That is, the idea that you can violate these rules, which looks so, and that this is the source of this nonsense, which is so essential to driving the engine of the Tractarian logic. It's so essential to the secondary readings, the standard readings, the Tractatus, is not in the book. Secondly, if you do, I mean, thanks to the fine work of people here in Bergen, we have an enormous electronic edition of Wittgenstein's entire corpus. And I have tried for fun to see if I can find any such idea in Wittgenstein's corpus. Now, mostly you've got to do searches in German. There's some text in English. You can look up words like violation. So you've got to decide how you're going to want to say this in German and set it up. So, I've searched every way I can think of to say this in German. And as far as I can tell, Wittgenstein never discusses this idea, early and late, except in a few very isolated contexts in which he is clearly criticizing it. One such context, it seems to me, in the Tractatus, arguably, is section 5.4733, which we might come to today. There are a couple of cases in the later writings, in philosophical works, the early writings that are still close to the Tractatus of concern, where you find an expression like gegen die Grammatikbrechung. It's now grammar instead of logic, but I think it's pretty close to the idea. Where do we get the idea that it's so much as possible to be able to engage in the activity of gegen die Grammatikbrechung? Question mark. Yes, it goes on the word. But then what he looks like he does in that section is to criticize that idea in ways I think are quite parallel to the ways in which he's criticizing the Tractatus. So just a small scholarly note. I don't think you can find this idea as a hook to hang this standard reading of the Tractatus, and you've got to read it into the book. It doesn't prove it's wrong. Just quite striking. I have said this to certain commentators many years ago before debates about how to read this book became more familiar, and they just thought, that's absurd. The Charkhanas talks about violation of logical syntax all over the place. It's the basic idea of the book, and I invited them to show me where. And then they were quite perplexed when they looked around the book and realized, my God, you can't actually find those words. But they're all over Max Black, Rudolf Carnap, Peter Hacker. They're in the next quotation from Peter Geech. This Geech quotation is drawn from the someplace as the quotes from Geech we looked at last time that are on the first handout, which is the article I recommended for last time. And part of the reason I'm giving the Geech quotation is because in Geech, he's very much concerned to develop a conception of how to read the Charkhanas that he sees as coming directly out of Frege. And in particular, directly out of an understanding of the issues in Frege that we were talking about last week. So, what we saw last week in Frege was the idea that there are certain logically fundamental notions. And if you want to convey these logically fundamental notions, first of all, you're going to have to use words which themselves do not correspond to any expression in a logically well-regimented language, in the Griffstrums. Just reminding you of things we said last week. Because there could be no such words for such a thing in a logically well-regimented language. And moreover, you're going to come out with sentences when their very form seem to resist the possibility of, this is what the quotation that Harold was asking about at the beginning of today was connected to, expressions that language itself forces us into, which if we were using a Begriffsschrift, a logically well-designed language, in which the mode of symbolizing of each expression was clear from the way in which it's written in the notation itself, we would find we were no longer able to come up with sentences like this. We could not translate the sentences we want to use in an elucidation of logically primitive notions in a logically precise notation. So, Geech understands this in the following way. Now taking Wittgenstein to be building on this feature of Frege, maybe it's actually worth going back and looking at one of our Geech quotations from last week just so you have the transition. So let's start with quotation 23 on the third of the Geech quotations we have on page 3 there. Frege held that there are logical category distinctions. The one we discussed in detail last week was the distinction between concept and object, but that's just an example. There are logical category distinctions which will clearly show themselves in well-constructed formalized language, but which cannot properly be asserted in language. The sentences in which we seek to convey them in the vernacular are logically improper and admit of no translation to well-formed formula of symbolic logic. That's the background I want for our quotation for today, on handout 2, quotation 23. So now we're getting a view of Wittgenstein and the Charkhanas, a little later in that article, but building on this reading of Frege and a certain understanding of the relationship between early Wittgenstein and Frege. Geech says, quote, Wittgenstein holds that various features of reality come out in our language. But we cannot use this language to say, assert, that reality has these features. We try to frame propositions ascribing these features to reality. It will be possible to show that, strictly speaking, this is another phrase, we had a note to discuss language, what do I mean by that? Another phrase that's coming up in these quotations, came up in the first quotation, we might come back to is, strictly speaking, you might ask, how does that work here? What kind of conception of loosely speaking is that opposed to here? Strictly speaking, these are not propositions. Only sentence-like structures which violate the principles of logical syntax, there's our phrase, and are thus devoid of any sense, true or false. All the same, These nonsensical structures may be useful. They may serve to convey from speaker to hearer an insight that cannot be put into proper propositions. Convey, insight, hear, could be put in quotation marks in which the word grasp and meant were a moment ago. For Hacker. And if we press each on this, he'd admit that quotation marks are required. So we see Geach here seeing Wittgenstein as simply extending Frege's conception and generalizing it to more cases. And the Tractatus is then meant to be sort of an amassive sort of exemplification of this Fregean practice of conveying insights through engaging in the traffic of these sentences, which we are supposed to come to see involve violations of logical syntax. By reflecting on what would be involved in the construction of a proper notation and seeing that these sentences cannot be conveyed in such a notation. Now, the reason I like Geach is that I think he is very close to getting the Tractatus right. I mean, he's sort of pushing the standard reading to the point where it's about to explode itself. So one of the things he's got right, I think, is that this topic in Frege is very important to the Tractatus. Once you notice how much has already gone on in Frege and set up the parallel the way Geach has, you have the unfortunate conclusion from the point of view of someone like Hacker, which Geach is perfectly happy to live with, that it turns out everything we thought was original and great in the Tractatus, you know, with respect to this conception of quote, saying, showing, so understood, is already in Frege. So that's a little awkward. It looks like early Wittgenstein's guilty of plagiarism, or at least cashing in credit that's not his. But otherwise, at least we have a reading. But I want to think, no, there is originality here. And the reason there's originality is that the Tractatus is not just acquiescing in this conception of Frege, but it is itself the target. So we can have Frege be as interesting as Geach thinks he is without losing the possibility there's a place for the Tractatus to come out, which isn't just a repetition of Frege. So now, we need to make this idea of violations of logical syntax.
You wouldn't happen to know who actually was the first to use the expression logical syntax.
Well, the idea of logical syntax, those words like that, in just this way, is an important idea in the Tractatus, and the Tractatus is responsible for its tremendous influence. And maybe we'll say more on that when we come to Cunningham. But the conception of logical syntax I'm going to attribute to the Tractatus does not admit of this sort of conception of violation. So the problem is not attributing any of logical syntax to the Tractatus, it's attributing a conception of logical syntax in which the way it works is it lays down rules that can be broken, and then you debar the cases in which it's violated. So if we're just talking about the expression logical syntax, now, we do have earlier developments in logic, early in the century, with David Hilbert, and then together with his student in the teens, so still contemporaneous with Wittgenstein, Ackermann, in which you're getting a conception of logic in which what is now called, reading back, a syntax semantics distinction is being drawn. And at a certain point, Hilbert and Ackermann themselves express that terminology, adopt that terminology of syntax and semantics, which is not actually theirs, to describe their own view. But that terminology was mostly developed in the late 20s and early 30s by the positivists who were themselves influenced by Wittgenstein, but I think actually the source of the misreading of the Tractatus that I'm here trying to trace. And then it's used to also denote something that you have in the beginnings of modern logical theory of a sort that we now teach in the classroom. You get Hilbert and Ackermann. But I want to claim that idea of syntax, as opposed to semantics, is not the same thing as what the Tractatus meant by logical syntax. So the history of logic here is quite complicated. So if you mean the words logical syntax, The answer is the Tractatus. If you mean not just the words logical syntax, but the words logical syntax standing for the conception of logical syntax that's being read back into the Tractatus here, such that, among other things, it admits of violations and it can be seen as prescribed and legitimate combinations of signs. Logical syntax governs signs, what the Tractatus would call signs, for Hilbert Ockham. Logical syntax of the Tractatus is only concerned with symbols, we'll see. So it's a very different conception of syntax. That conception itself is owed to these figures, but it's not called, it's not denoted by this vocabulary until later, where this vocabulary itself, as a matter of nomenclature, is due to people who think they're following the Tractatus. So the start of this is quite complicated. So I'm not exactly sure which question you're asking, but depending on which question you're asking, I've answered, I think, all the questions I could imagine you were answering.
But I mean, you objected to the phrase violations of the principles of syntax.
Right.
So that was a topic.
Well, it's not a topic to which something possible corresponds.
No. But of course, one could say, like, you can have a book on chemistry that doesn't contain the word chemistry.
Yeah.
You could have
sure,
a book
sure.
About
it. Oh, I agree. The fact that that expression is not occurring in the Tractatus doesn't prove anything. It's just surprising to some commentators because they find it so indispensable that Wittgenstein doesn't use it. But yeah, I agree. It's not probative. I didn't mean to suggest that it was.
The Dickens aren't actually used the expression principles of logical syntax.
He says things that can be translated that way, yeah. So for instance, look at quotation, jumping way ahead. Look at quotation, well, here it's translated as rules. Sometimes it's translated as rules, sometimes it's translated as principles. This is this is quotation 33 in your handout, sir. The expression is delaying of the logical syntax, which is sometimes translated rules, sometimes translated principles. But he doesn't mind speaking of rules in this context. I think principles does slightly work the topic. But the question is that how are such rules to be understood? This is just as much a topic for later readers. I'll be arguing a little bit later on in this seminar, in a week or two. That is to say, the conception of Baker and Hacker have of how to read later Wittgenstein is one in which it's no less fundamental to their reading of later Wittgenstein that what later Wittgenstein is trying to do is identify what they call rules of grammar and trace, what shall we call it, philosophical error, shall we call it, to the violation of such rules of grammar. So the fundamental conception of what Wittgenstein's up to early and late doesn't change much. The difference, and they have passages where they describe this quite eloquently, and I can maybe give you a quotation of this sort of 2 weeks from now. The difference is that early, according to Baker and Hacker, early Wittgenstein thought was a monist about logical syntax. He thought there was just one set of rules, the rules of logical syntax. They were the same for all languages. Whereas later Wittgenstein's a pluralist. He thinks we have many language games, there are many grammars. But the conception of what kind of misstep it is that philosophers make, and how it's to be diagnosed, and how these rules are to be uncovered, and then what sort of status they have once you've uncovered them, and how you're allowed to sort of bang people over the head with them and tell them to shut up, now that you've identified the true rules, be they of logical syntax or grammar. That conception is much the same for early and late. So, on the reading of Wittgenstein I'm giving you, he's already criticizing, in his early work, a conception that he's continuing to champion in his later work on most readings of him. It doesn't prove he's right, but it does prove that his thought has not been received from Rand. But we'll come back to the issue as the presence of that quotation later on. So just we'll come back to this issue, Harold. Okay. What I wanted to do is get a little sort of clear what it would mean to think something. What is it that people think they mean when they think something like the principles of logical syntax are violated? How do you identify such cases of violation? And one of the frustrating things about the literature in the Tractatus per se is that no one ever says very much about this. Partly because if they want examples of this from Wittgenstein, they're not going to get them. So again, here, I think the better literature on this is either people who are writing about someone before Wittgenstein, who Wittgenstein himself is considered to criticize, I think, even Frege or Russell, or the literature on Carnap, who I think has this kind of reading of the Tractatus that's trying to make it precise. So when I actually go into this issue in some detail, I first discuss, again, Frege and Frege commentators, and then later Carnap and Carnap commentators. So let's first take quotation four, which is from Dummett, giving his reading of Frege. First, just some quick notes before we do this. Dummett's quite a different reader of Frege than Geech's. That is, Geech's, we saw, wants to read something like what I was calling last week. This is defined in handout 1, for those of you who weren't here, and 15 through 20, page 3 of handout 1, and 19 and 20 of the crucial items. Geech wants to attribute what I was calling there the ineffability variant of the substantial conception nonsense to Frege. Nowhere in any of his writings have I ever seen Dummett suggest that he wants to read Frege that way. Rather, Dummett seems to be concerned with something more like the other variant of the substantial conception. That is, what's happening here has nothing to do with there being inexpressible thoughts for Dummett. It just has to do with language and breaking certain rules, saying things you can't say given the rules. But I do think one merit is that Dummett does lay out what's involved in such a conception of nonsense, and indeed in such a reading of Frege quite clearly. So this is quotation 4. He's talking about the kind of theory he finds in Frege here. He says, it's a theory of what expressions can be accepted as significant. So we have lots of expressions. Some of them are significant, some of them aren't. So far, so good. Only certain functions, those of the appropriate type, can occur significantly as arguments of other functions. Expressions which violate the theory of types are simply meaningless. And we talked about this last week, too. He's not here talking about Russell's theory of types, but an analogy, as I put it last week, between Russell's theory of types and Frege's conception of there being a hierarchy of kinds of expressions, object expressions, first-level functions, second-level functions, and so forth. But in both cases, the similarity is that you can only have predication one type level down. You can ascribe a concept to an object, you can ascribe a second-level function to a first-level function, and so forth. So I can say of Kato that he is a man. I can even say of Kato that he's a good man. So I'm here ascribing concept, being a good man, to an individual, Kato. And I can say, a good man is rare. There, I'm ascribing a second level function to a first level function, a concept, being a good man. I'm saying, of that concept, being a good man, that it does not have very many instances. So that kind of expression, the second level function, the idea is if you had a really well-regimented language, each of those expressions would be written in a different way and would have a differently inscribed argument place. So it would be clear what kind of expression you were allowed to plug into that argument place from the very way in which it's written, which is not clear in ordinary language. We have, therefore, as Dummett puts in the next quotation, I like this metaphor, I think it brings out the picture very nicely, It's a very nice, it's not Dhamma's intention, but what Dhamma does here is very nicely give expression to a very natural, almost universally held conception of logical or categorical necessity, which the Tractatus is trying to attack. He expresses it with the metaphor of logical valency, which I think is a very nice metaphor for this point. He's using a chemical metaphor, the metaphor of valency. The availability of this metaphor, I think, is not accidentally connected to the fact that analytic philosophy in 1898, with G.E. Moore and Bertrand Russell, analytic philosophy starts with the idea that philosophy consists in analysis. And their initial way of understanding what analysis meant there, quite explicitly in Moore's 1898 article, The Nature of Judgment, involved a chemical metaphor, chemical analysis. You have H2O. When you look at it, it just looks pure and simple and clear. Very much of it here. There's more of it there. But if you're a chemist, you can analyze it and decompose it into these very different elements and even discover, you know, lo and behold, there's twice as many of these elements as there are of those elements in any unit of H2O. And discover that it has what appears outwardly simple, when subjected to analysis, has inner complexity and multiplicity of a sort that can be unveiled. And in grasping this, we grasp the true nature of that which we are analyzing. So similarly, propositions were supposed to be candidates for analysis in the same way that chemistry had shown us that apparently simple forms of nature or matter were candidates for analysis. That there was a fine structure there to be uncovered. So that there's been a chemical metaphor, as it were, informing analytic philosophy since its inception. But Dummett brings out a further feature of the conception that's in fact optional. You can like this idea without buying into this idea, but the one very naturally comes with the other, and I think more or less universally holds sway still, which is the idea also that this feature of the chemical case applies to the left-hand side of our analogy, the nature of thought, language, or whatever it is you think analytical philosophy is investigating. It's a feature of chemistry that there are, as it were, these elements which are independently available. I can give you pure oxygen, I can give you pure hydrogen, and so forth. And then these independently available elements, which can exist independently of these compounds in which we happen to encounter them, in some cases can be combined and in some cases cannot. There's certain kinds of combinations that are not possible. There are other kinds, just let me complete the metaphor. There are other kinds of combinations like this one that are possible. So chemical valency has to do with, you know, in the end, ultimately, with electronic charge and what kinds of, you know, bits of matter can glom on to what kinds of bits of matter and what kinds of bits of matter cannot. Sorry.
I was just wanting about the metaphor, because in chemistry, it's always H, no matter what. But part of it, or that you bring out in your article, is that for Frege, that's a mistake, looking at the individual units, because you've got to see them together, and then sometimes when it is somewhere, it's something else in another constellation. But H is always H, no matter what it's combined with. But
let's put it differently. The conditions for identifying H are such that the fundamental criteria for something's being H is not it's occurring a certain kind of compound, but it's having certain kinds of properties in isolation. Whereas for Frege, the fundamental criteria for identifying something as a certain kind of subpropositional unit is its occurrence across a certain number of compounds, you know, what we could here call compounds. It's being the common part of these compounds. So in the Tractatus, in the 3.3s, explains what it means by an expression, the thing that looks like, you know, the corresponding thing to a chemical element, an expression, is something which propositions have in common. That is essentially what an expression is. H2O is not essentially what, you know, these different chemical compounds have in common. What H essentially is this stuff we can have by itself. That's
maybe I'm just taking those three principles of Frege too literally. I haven't read much Frege by himself.
Yes.
But you seem to, in your article, the take them quite literally. And that it seems to me, even across expressions, if you're going to think the way that you just said, you're still isolating an individual out, and that's exactly what he's saying you shouldn't do those three principles.
See, what I'm worried here, the reason I wanted to reformulate what you said to make the motivation more explicit is I'm worried you're equivocating on the notion of expression. So if I talk about H2O and I talk about just H, I'm using H in the same sense. Even if I just, you know, I'm talking about the first, you know, I don't know what it is, 27 seconds of the universe, according to the latest theories of the Big Bang, in which the only element so far formed is hydrogen. Oxygen has not yet been formed. Helium, I guess, is the next one to come, has not yet been formed. we haven't got fast enough reaction time. There was a point in the history of the universe in which there was just hydrogen and nothing else. That notion of H, that which we had then when there was only H, and that which this expression stands for when we write H2O, have the same significance. We're using H in the same sense. Whereas what Frege is going to say is, the thing that you're identifying as the same across propositions in which the sign is symbolizing in different ways is not the same expression in this sense of expression. What those things have in common, I'll get this clear in a moment, is a mere sign, not a symbol. So the thing which Frege is interested in having the same is something that can only be identified through its occurrence in certain kinds of propositional compounds. So the thing that you want to talk about when you say in isolation, when you start saying that, from Frege's point of view, you've changed the subject.
Well, I mean, my whole reason for putting this out is that I think the logical valency metaphor seems to have a weakness in it, that it's not quite the same. That's all I wanted to.
Very good.
That was my, and it seems to me that you,
Okay, very good. I see your point. That's exactly what I'm going to try to bring out, is that the logical valency, if you try to combine the logical valency metaphor with the interpretation of Frege, you try to keep this feature, as it were, of Russell and Moore's initial conception of analytic philosophy with the interpretation of Frege, which is what Dummett's here trying to do, then you'll be subject to attention, which you were nicely bringing out, which is that you're both going to want to be able to say that the elements are function the way they do in chemistry. So we can say things like, there are certain parts that cannot be combined. And we do see Frege saying this. So one of the things I want to say is that this is the tension that Wittgenstein finds in Frege himself. So the quotations I give you right away off of this Dummett quotation, 6, 7, and 8, I've italicized the bits where, you know, Frege is talking about, you know, almost as if he read the Dummett, parts not being able to logically cohere. So there, Frege does seem to be in the throes of something like this kind of metaphor. Whereas the kind of passage in Frege I think you were thinking of is the kind of thing we had in last week's handout when, if you look at something like quotation 31, where Frege is noting that the very logic of talk of parts, when we're talking about parts of a thought, seems to be of a very different sort than we're talking about parts that are decomposable this way, the relationship between part and whole and the identification of the part through the whole works in a different way. Let's just, you know, flesh out this metaphor a little bit more. And to do that, I was going to take us to quotation 9, which is also from the Dummett. Oh my God, it's 11:15. How did that happen? We'll stop a moment. I do feel that was an amazing offense. Precisely because natural language violates the principle that each expression, incomplete in sense, must carry with it its argument place, depending upon what's a monadic or dyadic or whatever, polyadic relation. It does become possible with a natural language to form meaningless but grammatically correct sentences, which violate the distinctions of type. And the symbolic language cannot be deconstructed at all. There's much that we could go over in this first sentence, but just to press on for now. For instance, the sentence Chairman Mao is rare, while perfectly grammatical, is meaningless. Because rare, just thinking of rare as an example of, oh, Kato's a good man, a good man is rare. Though in appearance, just like a first level predicative adjective, that is, Kato is a man, Kato is rare. Kato is good, that would be a better example. Kato is good, Kato is rare. They look like they have the same surface grammar. There's no clear argument place of a different sort of inscribing the one as in the other. Done in appearance, just like the first level predicate adjective, has the sense of a second level predicate. The diagnosis and explanation of such failures of significance in natural language can easily be accomplished by reference to the impossibility of constructing a corresponding sentence in the symbolic language. So this is the moment that converges with Geech's reading. See, is we have a properly regimented language. Then we'll realize, gee, given the kind of expression we write for Kato, a little name, and given the kind of argument place we give rare, if it's a second level function, we're not allowed to plug that into that. We're only allowed to plug a concept expression into that argument place. So we would be breaking a rule of our language. So there is such a rule to break. That rule has been enshrined in the design of the project of properly regimented language. But ordinary language allows us to break this rule. When we break this rule, we come out with nonsense. So trying to make the picture of what's going on a little more explicit here. In 10, I give you two sentences. And if you can get clear about this, we need to be clear whether we're talking about what the Tractatus calls signs or symbols. So if we're talking about symbols, then we need to. The Tractatus and Frege, I think, is going to think we first need to specify which symbols we're talking about. And we can only do that by looking at expressions in some proposition functioning in some way, so we can see what the logical role of those signs is and how they are symbolizing in that context. That's Frege's second principle that we talked about last week. So I give you two such propositions here, A and B. Chairman Mao ate only boiled rice. That specifies a symbol, the one that's contributing to the overall sense of the sentence. Chairman Mao ate only boiled rice. An honest politician is rare. His true today is only first used this example 20 years ago. That specifies the use of the expression is rare, where it is a second level function. And now what we want to do is say, we're forming a sentence using that symbol and that symbol and combining. We've just done it. I've done it when I say Chairman Mao is rare. So I'm telling you how to understand Chairman Mao is rare. Chairman Mao is rare involves the Chairman Mao of Chairman Mao ate only boiled rice and the blank is rare of an honest politician is rare. But I'm substituting in the blank that was formally filled by a concept expression, an honest politician, something which is not a concept expression. I'm plugging it in with the thing that was underlined in it. So I'm combining the two symbols that correspond to the two underlying parts of propositions A and B to form C. That's what C is. That's the meaning of C. So in order to explain why it's, as Dummett puts it, meaningless or nonsensical, it looks like I first have to tell you, in another sense, what its meaning is, or at least what its meaning is supposed to be. It's supposed to be the combination of this and that to arrive at this proposition. That is, it appears to have a determinate kind of a sense about which we then want to say. That determinate specification of a possible kind of sense is impossible. And then the question is, can we do this? If we really think this through, is it so clear that what we've got in C is what we want to claim we've got in the way that this diagram of just constructing 10 suggests we have? This seems like a good moment to take a break. Come back in 5 or 7 minutes and answer.